This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2 days ago, on board Air Force Two, high above the Middle East, after his surprise visit to Iraq, Vice President Dick Cheney invited reporters up to talk about the power of the presidency. It eroded after Vietnam and Watergate, he said, but he and George W. Bush are bringing it back. In threatening times like these, he said, wartime, the president of the United States needs to have his constitutional powers unimpaired, strong, robust. War and war powers have always tested the boundaries of presidential authority. This hour, we look at the history as President Bush now takes heat on domestic surveillance without warrants. Up next on Point, advisor to four presidents, David Gergen, on the record of presidents at war. Joining me in the studio is David Gergen. He served as an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Bill Clinton. He's director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a professor of public service there. He's also author of the best-selling book, Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership from Nixon to Clinton. David Gergen, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
David Gergen, first, we'll dive into the history, but let us understand so we can kind of hear the background music as we go to history, what you make of George W. Bush's step with the NSA, domestic surveillance on international calls and all the rest, within or without the appropriate bounds of presidential wartime power.
Well, it's certainly understandable that the president would want to take aggressive action to trace down the bad guys and stop them before they pull triggers or fly airplanes into buildings. But at the same time, we do have a constitutional system, in my judgment, we had settled this question of whether we could wiretap on people domestically without court surveillance, and that issue was resolved, I think, with considerable clarity in the 1970s after the Nixon period. By the Congress and with presidential signature, we passed a law that said the president, if he wants to wiretap, can do that, but we have special courts to do it. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's very regrettable, and I think it is, whether it's illegal or not, it's clearly an end run around the system, what's happened here recently. And many believe outside the executive branch, not within the executive branch, but outside the executive branch, many experts do believe it's a violation of the law.
When you look at it in the context of end runs, to say the very least, that presidents have taken in earlier wars.
Right.
Does this look egregious? Does this look in line with history? Is it history that we should avoid repeating?
I think it's superficially it bears parallels to what we've seen in the past, and that is we know that in other wars there has been an expansion of presidential authority. The presidents have acted to the limits and sometimes beyond the limits of their authority. But frequently, as Alexis de Tocqueville foresaw back in the 1830s, that war would bring an expansion of presidential authority. But there are serious distinctions, and issues like this, you know, distinctions matter. That's what the law is all about, is trying to make fine distinctions. And one of those distinctions is that Lincoln and many of his contemporaries, all the way up and through the first part of the 20th century, they saw their exercises of power during wartime as emergency measures that had to be ratified by Congress. For example, when Lincoln suspended the habeas corpus proceeding or process during the Civil War so he could get troops through Baltimore, he did it with the understanding that he wanted Congress later to ratify it, and he sought that ratification. What we have seen in more recent years, especially since the beginning of the Cold War, are assertions by presidents that they have inherent powers that are granted under the commander-in-chief title. And that the presidency itself has inherent powers. They're not emergency measures that have to be ratified by Congress. Rather, these are things we can do. We don't need ratification by anybody. This just goes along with being commander-in-chief. That's what the controversy is about. And most scholars have said the assertion of inherent, almost unlimited, unchecked powers in the presidency is exactly what the framers did not intend.
But exactly what, very nearly, it seems, Vice President Cheney was suggesting just this week. He was flying from Islamabad to Oman, brought reporters into his private cabin and said the powers of the presidency eroded after Vietnam and Watergate. We need to bring them back. We're doing that. We're going to bequeath to our successors a stronger presidency. You're saying this in your view, outside the vision of the framers?
It is certainly outside the vision of the framers. This issue of war-making authority was discussed quite extensively in the Constitutional Convention of 1787 and Philadelphia. And Edmund Randolph of Virginia put forward the notion and wanted to enshrine in the Constitution that the war-making authority would rest with the president. And that was decisively rejected by the framers, who said, no, the war-making authority and with its attendant kind of authorities to would rest with Congress, and the president would be commander-in-chief, but in a more limited sense than it's being expressed today. I have some sympathy with what Vice President Cheney is expressing. After all, I have worked in Republican administrations and worked with Dick Cheney and saw the president being the balance shift during the 1970s as after the Nixonian excesses, Congress reasserted itself. I think properly. I must say I've gone through an evolution of my thinking. As someone who first worked in the White House, I believe very strongly the president needs as much authority as he can because you couldn't govern in there for a while during the 70s and the early 80s. But I've come around very much to the view that checks and balances are an extraordinarily important, wise way to approach government, and that one man's wise use of authority, expansive use of authority, can become another man's capacity for abuse.
We're going to go all the way back to very early days and march through, but let's listen to a moment that at least in modern history was considered a kind of nadir or description of it around the use of presidential powers at war. Here's President Nixon, who one of the presidents that David Gergen worked for, had a famous series of interviews with British journalist David Frost. Here he's responding to questions about his Houston plan, which called for wiretappings and burglaries against anti-Vietnam War groups and others. Nixon was told by White House counsel that some of the actions were illegal. But Nixon approved the plan anyway. Here he begins explaining why he didn't just draft legislation to get permission for the program.
To get legislation, specific legislation, to have warrantless entries for the purpose of obtaining information and the rest, would not only have raised an outcry, but it would have made it terribly difficult to move in on these organizations, because basically they would be put on notice by the very fact that the legislation was on the books that they'd be potential targets. And action's either going to be covert or not.
So what in a sense you're saying is that there are certain situations, and the Houston plan or that part of it was one of them, where the president can decide that it's in the best interest of the nation or something, and do something illegal.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
By definition.
Exactly.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal. A view expressed there with David Frost by President Richard Nixon, a view rather decisively rejected by Congress in the years after the Nixon presidency.
But I want to come back to this distinction again. There is a real difference between what it was envisioned that the president could act and use extensive powers in an emergency. If we were attacked, it was always envisioned that the president could respond.
In the moment.
In a moment. And there are going to be emergency situations where the president must act and act swiftly, and hopefully they'll get the Congress to embrace it, as Lincoln got it later on, and the courts will go along at the time to get through the emergency. But one of the differences between what we face now and those past emergencies is this war against terrorism has this hazy quality about
open-ended.
It. Open-ended to go on for some years.
We're talking this hour about presidents and presidential powers in wartime with David Gergen, advisor to four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. We'll hear in a few minutes as well from Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Tribe to join us on the legal side of this. Let's hear the voice of the president. This is from his very recent press conference. Here he's responding to questions about his own secret order to allow warrantless spying on Americans. The first voice you'll hear is Peter Baker, reporter for The Washington Post.
I wonder if you can tell us today, sir, what, if any, limits you believe there are or should be on the powers of a president during wartime, and if the global war on terror is going to last for decades, as has been forecast, does that mean that we're going to see, therefore, a more or less permanent expansion of the unchecked power of the executive in American society?
First of all, I disagree with your assertion of unchecked power. Hold a second, please. There is the check of people being sworn to uphold the law, for starters. There is oversight. We're talking to Congress all the time. And on this program, to suggest there's unchecked power is not listening to what I'm telling you. I'm telling you we have briefed the United States Congress on this program a dozen times. This is an awesome responsibility to make decisions on behalf of the American people, and I understand that, Vener. And we'll continue to work with the Congress, as well as people within our own administration, to constantly monitor a program such as the one I've described to you, to make sure that we're protecting the civil liberties of the United States. To say unchecked power basically is ascribing some kind of dictatorial position to the president, which I strongly reject.
President Bush responding to questions there in his recent press conference. No unchecked power here, he says. But then, of course, David Gherkin, we had the vice president, again, on the airplane somewhere over the Middle East, saying the War Powers Act itself, he believes, is unconstitutional and that it will be tested. Maybe it's being tested right now. We should take us back. Where do you see as the first place to kind of click into American history to begin to understand this in historical context?
Well, as we've said here, the framers did look at this question in the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and there were two debates that took place, at first introduced by Mr. Randolph of Virginia, and then a second one. Mm. And twice they decided that they did not want to place a war-making authority in the executive branch. So Article 1 is quite clear.
That's Congress will declare
Congress
war.
Congress will declare war, and then they give additional powers to the Congress, such as the power of the purse, the power of investigation, mm-hmm. and the like. And when in Article 2, when the president is named as commander-in-chief, remember what title that really is. George Washington was the commander-in-chief during the Revolutionary War. At that time, commander-in-chief was a military job to carry out a war, but subject to political authority of, in that case, the legislature. Mm-hmm. That's what was intended here. That's what was the notion. So what I find strange is for a conservative administration today, which is insisting upon going back to original intent and its justices and the people it appoints to the court, mm-hmm. paying so little attention to what the framers actually said about war making and about the executive powers. If we're going to believe in originalism with regard mm-hmm. to all sorts of other issues, mm-hmm. I don't know why you can make an exemption here. Alexander Hamilton,
yes,
who was one of the foremost proponents of expansive executive authority and, of course, fought with Jefferson over that issue, mm-hmm. made it quite clear in the Federalist Papers that the executive was not to be entrusted with all war-making authority and would not to be entrusted with sort of exclusive responsibility over foreign affairs. That was essentially vested in Congress. Mm-hmm. Federalist 75 from Hamilton says, "The history of human conduct does not warrant that exalted opinion of human virtue, which would make it wise to commit in interests of so delicate and momentous a kind as to those which concern its intercourse with the rest of the world, mm-hmm. to the sole disposal of a president of the United States." Mm-hmm. It was intended by the framers that the president in this case would be, in effect, subject and would have to be responsive to, with the sole exception mm-hmm. that the president could respond to emergencies. Mm-hmm. It was always understood that there was an inherent power to respond to emergencies, but if the president had to use emergency powers, he'd come back and seek approval by the Congress, as Lincoln did with habeas corpus, mm. and as Jefferson did at various times along the way.
So, but then, of course, the original intent always tested by circumstance. Lincoln declaring suspending habeas corpus, April 1861, and even when that action was overturned by U.S. Circuit Court in Maryland, Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, Lincoln ignored Taney's order. I mean, is that a first example?
Well,
I mean,
if you go back to what Lincoln did, Maryland was a slave state, mm-hmm. And it was in a very delicate situation. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people in Maryland who hated the idea of war and wanted to stop it, and they wanted to stop the troop trains coming through Baltimore, mm-hmm. so they couldn't get to Washington. If you couldn't get to Washington, you couldn't prosecute the war.
Right.
And so Lincoln said, basically, look, I'm gonna suspend one law to save the system. I think mm-hmm. that's the proper thing to do. But mm-hmm. very importantly, he suspended habeas corpus in April of 1861. That summer, he came back and submitted to Congress a message which said, "I need you to approve what I am doing," which they did. So he didn't presume
it was his power.
He did not presume
forever
it was his inherent power mm-hmm. that could last through the rest of the war. He was looking for congressional approval. What we have seen, it doesn't start with Bush. Now, please, and this is not an mm-hmm. anti-Bush argument. It's rather that the presidents during the Cold War, and this reached an apex under Nixon, began to assert this inherent power of in the presidency. And I think it led to a whole pattern of abuses under Lyndon Johnson and under Richard Nixon, which the Congress then and the court said, no, we're not going down this path. We do not accept this notion, as Nixon said to David Frost, that when the president does it, it is not illegal. That is just not an acceptable notion.
Though when President Bush says there, look, it's all right because I've sworn to uphold the law, it's kind of equivalent of what Nixon said. I've sworn to uphold the law, so I must be upholding the law.
Sure, every president I know has upheld the law, but one hell of a lot of them have not necessarily obeyed it. And that's these checks and balances are important. With due respect, and I totally – everybody supports the notion that we've got – the President Bush ought to have the capacity to monitor phone calls and emails among bad guys. That's absolutely right. The question is whether it's going to be done with some sort of check on the system, and these special FISA courts, as they're called, were set up for that purpose. And what we know is that – let me just say two things. One, the president said – well, now that the cat's out of the bag, this is really going to you can't tell anybody about this. You have to keep it very secret because the bad guys will suddenly know you're tracking.
That change.
Come on. I mean, listen, everybody knows that we've been tracking bad guys. The bad guys know that.
Sure.
That's why they're so furtive. You know, and they're doing everything they can to change phones, get on different servers, send signals in one way or another. They understand somebody's trying to check in on them. That's not the issue for them. They know they're under surveillance. You basically, if you live in Washington these days, assume that you're probably under surveillance if you're a civilian.
I mean, that's a pretty lousy assumption.
Well, it is, but I worked in the White House, and I used to think my phones were bugged. My home phone was bugged. I mean, there were times that you could hear clicks on the phone. You started to say, those guys are changing tapes. I mean, there were times when I was talking to my kids over the phone, and it was hard to hear sometimes. We thought there were so darn many bugs
on it. But isn't that what this is all about, not allowing this circle of power to expand to the point where that assumption becomes widespread and we just accept it?
I think the great tragedy of this is, if this goes on, there's going to be a widespread view in the public that even when the government is not bugging you, they probably are. And that is a real curtailment of our freedom here in this country.
Fundamentally corrosive. David Gergen, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Lawrence Tribe, professor at Harvard Law School, one of America's leading constitutional lawyers. Lawrence Tribe, delighted to have you this morning. Thank you very much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
So here we are. You've heard President Bush. You've seen the actions that brought out in the press. You've heard his response. Where does this stand? We see what American presidents have done in many wars. They've taken some extreme steps, and we'll talk about more of them. Where do you see President Bush's steps in the war on terror in the context of what's been done in the past? And do you see a constitutional crisis here?
Well, you know, I have been listening to the program, and I agree completely with everything that David Gergen has said. And I think the experience that he had in the White House gives his words a degree of gravity that mine, as a scholar, can't really quite match, to be honest with you. There really is no precedent I can think of in our history for an assertion by a president that because we are in a state of war in which he has been authorized by Congress, and here Congress did step in, and we have to concede, I think, this much, in the joint resolution authorizing the use of military force, Congress said you can use military force to go after the bad guys and to bring them under control.
Right after 9/11.
There's no precedent when that kind of power has been used as an inherent open-ended authority to go after anyone in the country because they are thought perhaps to be talking to someone who's talked to one of the bad guys. And to do that in a war that is, as David Gergen has said, so hazy, so open-ended that it may not end in our lifetimes. That is really something which threatens the whole country in an important way that the court recognized in the 1960s when it said for the first time that wiretapping and eavesdropping is controlled by the Fourth Amendment. It said that if the expectations of the ordinary citizen are that the ear of the government is hidden behind every door, that will be a grave inhibition on freedom of communication. And when we're now told just days ago that the FBI is listening in and perhaps attending undercover
on vegetarians in Indianapolis and Catholic workers here and there and the works.
Right. Then everyone begins to assume that every conversation with their kids, with their friends, with anyone, whether or not overseas, and we're told domestic lines have been overheard as well, may be listened to by in some situation room in Washington.
Larry,
that would change the nature of this country.
Let me ask you this specifically. Do you believe that with his order for the NSA to conduct this domestic surveillance on international calls that the president has broken the law?
Yes,
are we in a constitutional crisis?
I think the president has broken the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Act, that he has clearly broken the act, and that it's not an excuse that he was authorized to use military force, that he has violated also the Fourth Amendment. And if the administration does not have the wisdom to back down, as both David Gergen and I hope it does, then I think we are in something of a constitutional crisis.
And if we are, what does it take to put the genie back in the bottle?
You know, that's a very hard question. People are not seriously talking about impeachment at the moment because, really, frankly, the House is in Republican control. Hearings by the House and by the Senate that will expose to the nation what's been going on may induce the administration to pull the genie back. But without some retreat by the administration and without a Congress that asserts itself more vigorously than it yet has, I don't see the genie being put back in the bottle, and I think that really is a serious problem. Crisis may suggest that it will come to a head and blow up. Perhaps that's the wrong image. What will happen instead is that the genie will dissipate and form a gray cloud of inhibition over the citizenry and gradually help to change the nature of the nation that we are.
Lawrence Tribe, there's a pretty stark rendering. I know we just have you for a few minutes. I thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Lawrence Tribe, professor at Harvard Law School. There it is, just as black and white and hard as could be, at least in Larry Tribe's view. David Gergen, we've just got a couple of minutes here. Take us a little further into how this might happen. How may we actually step back from this, if indeed it's a constitutional crisis, illegality on the plate?
In this instance, hearings are important, and then move beyond hearings, just as they did on the torture subject. You know, when John McCain and others led the way, they got the votes in the House and the Senate. The White House strongly opposed any kind of limitations on what they could do to detainees, quote, or rendering all the rest. But McCain had the votes. And the president signing the law. The president has now agreed to do that. That's what the Congress has to do now. The Congress has to shake off its lethargy and its indifference to some of these issues and really speak up. That's if one of the reasons the presidents have asserted and gotten so much more authority is Congresses have been so weak and deferential. And in this case, they've got to get over beyond their pusillanimity and pass laws. And I think John McCain and Arlen Specter and some other Republicans can help to lead the way on that.
There's a call for some old-time conservatism, the kind that might stand straight up to an abuse of power if it sees it and calls it. David Gergen, director for the Center of Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership from Nixon to Clinton, advisor to Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Bill Clinton. It's been wonderful having you with us. Thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate being with Professor Tribe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.